It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Lars. Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
The 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Now, honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a Monday night, and glad to take your calls as well. There's a lot going on today. Two major Supreme Court rulings, one involving the religious freedoms of Americans, and there the Supreme Court acted appropriately and upheld those religious freedoms. And second, the unanimous decision that President Donald Trump was right all along about his temporary travel ban from six countries that are predominantly Muslim. You can find that in our quick poll tonight. I'm going to ask you straight out, was the Supreme Court right to reinstate the president's temporary travel ban from six largely Muslim countries? I would say yes, they were right. And it was a unanimous decision. Even the liberals on the court thought the president had the legal authority to do what he did. Even somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg could not come up with a good legal reason why Trump should not be allowed to impose that ban. And as we pointed out tonight, even the liberals on the court did not bring up President Trump's comments on the campaign trail as part of their evidence, as the other 16 appellate court judges had decided to do in those lower court rulings, which only reinforces my opinion of the Ninth Circus Court of Appeals, the craziest court in America that is routinely overruled by the United States Supreme Court. Find my quick poll at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens, the kind of conservative values that most of us believe in. Just go to amac.us to join or call 888-262-2006. AMAC's better. Better for you and better for America. In Friday's quick poll, we ask you this: is actor Johnny Depp's assassination comment a threat against the president of the United States? 88% of you joined me in voting yes on that. Only 12% of you said that it was not a threat. Boy, would I love to talk to one of the naysayers in that case and ask them, how could you not read that as a threat against the life of the president? In any case, there's a lot more going on around America. When a same-sex couple has a baby, should they both be able to list their names on the birth certificate, even though one is clearly not the biological parent? We'll talk about that. The left is crying that the new health care bill is going to leave millions uninsured. I'll speak with the president of the Pacific Research Institute about the realities of what the GOP health care bill will actually do for our country. And rumors are now swirling that the 80-year-old Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy might be getting ready to retire. Attorney Mark Miller will join me to talk about who would be a good option to fill his seat if it's open. Can you imagine? That would be a second appointment for President Trump. And when Ginsburg finally hangs it up, that is a third appointment. In other words, as I told a group on Saturday night that I was giving a speech to, my 15-month-old granddaughter, well, she'll be 15 months old on the 1st of July. My 15-month-old granddaughter will be able to enjoy at least the first 50 years of her life with a solidly conservative Supreme Court. And cronyism is in full effect in New York City at the City Council. I'll give you details on that as well. And make sure you cast a vote in the quick poll at LarsLarson.com. I'll get to your calls in just a moment, but I wanted to share something with you. There's a good friend of mine. He's one of the best talkers in America. He is John Carlson. And he took a call from a gentleman this morning that I thought illustrated a problem that America's been up against. Most American cities have been confronting this problem. And the problem is the police, when they confront somebody who's got mental illness, who is posing a danger to himself or others, oftentimes the police are forced to take that person's life. And we say, well, gosh, isn't there a way to defuse that system, that situation, and make sure that we don't have to forfeit the life of that individual? Have you ever thought about what that individual might go on to do in the years after the police have talked him down from a dangerous situation? This caller is the brother of a man who's in exactly that situation. His brother has been crazy for most of his life. His brother is now locked up in prison for the rest of his life. But he had a confrontation where the police could have easily, would have been very justified in taking his life. They did not. And do you know what that man went on to do? He raped and murdered a woman who had just graduated from college and who was about to be married. Take a listen to the call, because I thought it was very instructive.
I'm a black American. I've never been to Africa in my entire life, and neither has any of my family members. I grew up in upstate New York, and I want to share a story about my older brother who is serving life today in prison. Years ago, he was confronted by several police officers. I was there, and my older brother was there as well. And they were questioning him. He was acting stupid. Out of the blue, out of nowhere, he picked up a police woman, grabbed her by the throat, and threw her through a plate glass window. Now, the police, they subdued him. They did not shoot and kill him. And they could have. But they subdued him, they put him in restraints and took him off to jail. Years later, during another trial, another incident, and I'll tell you about that in a moment, we found out that my brother was diagnosed as schizophrenic. We just thought, as children growing up, that he was evil because his illness always came out that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Years later, several years later, he killed, brutally raped and killed his neighbor, bludgeoning her with a knife, and he slaughtered her in her apartment. She was set to be married. She had just graduated from college, and she never got to attend her wedding. And my brother is serving life, and, you know, it was a horrible situation for our families to go through, both families. But had the police officers shot and killed my black brother, who was out of his mind most of his life, that young woman would be alive today. And so I am just fed up, sick to death with the racial connotations every time a police officer who I support and call, and they have to be on my payroll as a taxpayer, has to shoot some crazy person who is trying to hurt them or others. And I've just about had it with these people. Now, please understand, I have dealt with bad police officers, very few, over the years, and particularly in Rochester, New York, where I come from. But the police officers that I know and support were not those people. And like my brother, I have dealt with bad people. And there are some bad people in the world. And for this whole thing to be race-based all the time just sickens me. And I wanted to come on and share that story because I am glad my brother is behind bars. That's the best place for him to be so that he doesn't hurt and kill anybody else. And I wish that the police officers had shot him and perhaps murdered him in order for that young girl to live. And I'm just tired of people always saying that it's the cops shooting a black person because of racism. No. If they had shot my brother, they would have been justified to do so, and that young lady would be alive today. And I wanted to share that on your program. I listen every day. Thank you, guys.
That is a fellow from my neck of the woods. His name is Jeff. And he was simply suggesting that sometimes when the police save somebody's life by de-escalating a situation, that's a popular word right now in police departments around America, yes, you save his life at that moment. But if you had to ask yourself, if somebody's been asking or acting crazy enough in his life that the police would be justified in shooting and killing him, and you defuse the situation and his life is saved, whose life have you decided will be forfeit because of it? In his case, he went off and raped and murdered a young lady who had just finished college, and she would be alive today. So I just want you to think about that. The police don't have a way of looking into a time machine and figuring out what somebody's going to do, but I will tell you this. The best way to predict any kind of behavior by an individual is to take a look at the way he's behaved in the past. And if you think about your own life, you're likely to have good examples of that. If somebody's lied to you before, they're likely to lie again. If they've been a drunk before, they're likely to be a drunk again. If they've shot heroin before, they're likely to shoot heroin again. And if they've hurt before, they may do that again.
Got something to say? Call 866-HEY-LARS to join the conversation now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you and always a pleasure to welcome back to the program Sally Bipes, the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute, a columnist for Forbes.com, and the author of several books, including The Way Out of Obamacare. Ms. Bipes, it's good to have you back on.
Well, thank you, Laura. It's great to be back. Lots going on in healthcare.
You can help us sort this out then. The most recent news hit today, of course, is the Congressional Budget Office coming out with the number that's been translated by the left-wing media to say that, why, if this crazy Republican bill becomes law, that 23 million Americans will lose their health insurance over the next 9 years or so. I know that's not true, but why don't you help me sort out what the real truth of that statement is?
Right, and it's just 1 million fewer than the American Health Care Act, the AHCA, that the House passed on May 4th. I just don't believe that number for a couple of reasons. One, the CBO, when they came out with their predictions for enrollment on the exchanges in 2016, they predicted 21, 22 million Americans would buy exchange coverage. In fact, that number came in at about 9 million, and this year we have about 10 million signed up on the exchanges. So how can we believe their numbers when their estimates for exchange enrollment have been so bad? The other thing is that, Lars, they don't really look into, you know, if we repeal and replace Obamacare and the insurance market is opened up, there will be a number of new types of products that people will actually purchase that fits their needs rather than having to buy a plan that has all of these essential health benefit mandates, like as is the case in Obamacare. So so many people today that have exchange coverage can't afford to use their coverage because of high premiums and the high deductibles. I mean, an average family to have to cover on a bronze plan a deductible of $12,000, it's just not possible. So anyway, I think they don't look at what the opportunities are for people who, you know, will get new types of coverage, and their estimates have been so out of whack with what the reality is.
Now, let me ask you this. Is it fair to state it this way, that the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is saying if we stop subsidies to certain kinds of health insurance, then we assume that those people will simply go without health insurance, which I guess I've tried to compare it to other things, and I don't know if it's an apt comparison, but if I said if the mortgage tax deduction went away tomorrow, you know, and you were no longer allowed to deduct the interest on your mortgage, that no one would buy a house in America ever again. And I think that's not true. But I think there'd be plenty of people who own homes without the mortgage tax deduction. It would be more expensive. It might put a greater burden on them. But there would still be people who would seek to own a home, even if the government didn't subsidize it. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, it is. And I come from Canada, where we never had mortgage interest deductibility, and people had to pay a much greater a greater share of their income down on a home. And so we had fewer people having to abandon their homes because they couldn't afford them. So I think mortgage interest deductibility, you know, allows people to put more into a home. And, you know, when there's a recession, more people actually default on their mortgage. So, but people will get homes, as they do in countries around the world, such as in Canada, where, you know, prices for houses are up, way up, and in England. So I think it's just they're not telling the full story.
Well, and here's the other piece that I think gets left out, and you tell me where you come down on this. If we stay with the current system, you know, the so-called Affordable Care Act, the wheels are coming off the bus on this. I mean, when Anthem pulls out of Indiana and Ohio, when there are 40
and
or
Wisconsin.
When 40 or 50 counties in America have no insurance provider at all, including one in my home state of Washington, that it's as though we're saying, we're standing on this rock in the middle of the stream. Should we step to the next rock? And everybody's arguing about whether or not the next rock will adequately support us. I'm pointing out that the rock we're standing on right now is rapidly dissolving.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I really truly believe that Obamacare is in a death spiral. When Donald Trump was running for the presidency, he said, we are going to repeal and replace disastrous Obamacare. It is a disaster because, you know, the premiums have been so high, double-digit premium increases, when the president promised the average family would see their premium go down by $2,500 a year, deductibles that are so high that a family, you know, that has to spend $12,000 on a family can't afford to use their coverage, small networks of doctors and hospitals where many people can't find that they can't use their own doctors, and then insurance companies getting out. And in addition to 47 counties in Ohio, Missouri, and Washington not having any plan, Aetna and Humana aren't going to be in any exchange plans next year, and they now announced that, you know, a long time ago, even before the president, Donald Trump, became the president. So Obamacare is in a death spiral. It's not working. The Medicaid, the people on Medicaid, we now have 74 million Americans on Medicaid because of the expansion, but a lot of these people are having a very difficult time finding a doctor because docs are reimbursed so low that emergency room use in the expansion states is up. And that was one of the whole ideas of Obamacare, was that people wouldn't have to, you know, use expensive emergency room service.
Well, and in fact, this is supposed to be one of the hallmarks of Obamacare, is that it's cut medical spending. Well, as you said, if you have that family on the bronze plan where their deductible is $12,000, they're only going to go to the doctor when they absolutely have to, because it's entirely out of pocket. So they're paying a lot of money for an insurance plan that they almost, it's virtually impossible for them to collect on unless they have a medical catastrophe in their family and they run up $12,000 in bills, and they have to pay the first $12,000 before they get to take advantage of any of the real insurance. And in most cases, those families, if they're average families on a gross income of $55,000 or $60,000, they don't have $12,000 to spend on medical care, which means they never meet the deductible and they never get any good out of it. And yet that's viewed as some kind of win for Americans because they're officially covered, even though unofficially they have no effective coverage at all.
Yes, what good is it to have a medical insurance card if you can't use it? It's like in Canada, where I'm from, across, you know, the border from Washington State, from Vancouver. I mean, as Madam Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin said, access to a waiting list is not access to care. And the same thing with the deductible. If you can't afford to use the coverage, what good is it to have an insurance card?
Now, the other piece of this is the Medicaid, because an awful lot of states, and I happen to work in one of them, the state of Oregon, where our broadcast studios are, about one person in four is on Medicaid, just as you say. And the state's looking at $500 million that it has to match with all that federal funding, and they don't know where to get the money. So that kind of situation can't continue either. So when people say, well, but all those people are covered, they're covered as long as the state can afford it. And I think that some of the expansion states have decided we don't have the money to cover it.
Well, under the new Senate Better Care Reconciliation Act, which has been very much in the news since last Thursday, you know, under the Senate bill, the Medicaid expansion, is the rates are going to continue for 3 more years, and then they're going to begin a 3-year phase down. 31 states in the country, you know, expanded their Medicaid programs. After that, in 2025, they're going to tie Medicaid spending to the general rate of inflation. But, you know, this is one of the big sticking points in the, you know, the vote, which is supposed to happen on Thursday in the Senate, is that senators such as John Thune, Shelley Moore Capito, Rob Portman, in those states that expanded their Medicaid programs, they're all, you know, in a Twitter about, you know, they have to be able to have this federal funding because they've expanded Medicaid. They should never have been part of the of our healthcare system, but it is. But I think one of the things that really is disappointing to me is that the rollback of the Medicaid expansion is really being delayed 3 years, and then a pull down for 3 more years, 2025. As you know, in politics, this is a very long time, and I think, you know, it could mean that the Medicaid expansion could, you know, with change in the leadership and in the makeup of Congress, it could mean that it'll never end.
Absolutely. Sally Pipes is the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. She's also the author of The Way Out of Obamacare. Sally, thank you so much for the time. We'll be back in just a moment. You've got The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson, your dog in the fight.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on this Monday night. We broadcast 2 days live this week on Capitol Hill, and then we'll go down to Charlottesville, Virginia, away from our home studios. Mark Miller joins me now, who's the managing attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Mark, I thought you were the perfect guy to ask if Justice Anthony Kennedy hangs it up. and decides that he's going to retire from the Supreme Court, and we may hear that. We've been hearing some indications he might. We want to find out who would be a good replacement for him.
Well, Lars, thank you for having me on.
You bet.
You know, definitely the rumors have been, particularly over the weekend, that Justice Kennedy was considering announcing his retirement this week or even this morning. Of course, he did not announce that this morning. There are a number of judges. In light of President Trump's unique campaign promise, where he actually said, here's a list of 21 judges or 20 judges and one U.S. senator whom I would consider to replace Justice Scalia, and he then filled that promise when he was elected by appointing nominating Neil Gorsuch, who was then appointed to the court, confirmed to the court. We have that list of 21, now 20, that we can look at and think that there's a good chance President Trump would draw from that list again, since, of course, that was one of the most popular decisions he's made since he became president.
Well, and in fact, the left was left, as I recall the whole debate, they didn't even really have any specific objections to Gorsuch. I mean, their general objection would be he's a conservative, or at least he's a constitutionalist. I've noticed that I don't really read him as a conservative so much as a guy who just sticks to the Constitution. But the Constitution is a relatively conservative document when it comes to its view of, you know, how Americans and their government relate to each other. So in that case, if he draws from that list, he has as good a pick as Gorsuch, he should have no problem getting him confirmed, especially because the Democrats kind of they spent all their powder on the last fight.
Yes, yeah, certainly their decision a few years ago, you know, the Harry Reid rule to get rid of the filibuster with judges, which, of course, they then decide, you know, the Republicans then said, okay, well, tit for tat, we're now not going to follow it with the Supreme Court, leaves the Democrats exposed. And the list of 20 judges who remain, or 19 judges and one U.S. Senator, Mike Lee, that from the Trump shortlist, assuming he were to use it again, which is, he has not said he would, but there's no reason to think he would not at least look at it closely, you're looking at, you know, dye-in-the-wall, solid lawyers and judges with excellent credentials. And just like Gorsuch, and the Democrats struggled to criticize Gorsuch on any sort of substantive basis, the names that are remaining are similarly, it'd be very tough for the Democrats to attack them in the way they attacked, say, Robert Bork in the 80s or Clarence Thomas in the early 90s.
Let me ask you this, Mark, because the questions come up before about replacing, about Supreme Court judges. It's an appointment for life. They can stay as long as they like, and then they make the decision whether they're going to retire or not. I can't remember what percentage of them have either been, you know, medically disabled or who have died in office, like Justice Kennedy, Scalia. But it seems, do you think perhaps there's a move toward having judges, you know, quit a little bit earlier so that they're not hanging in there until the very last minute? Because one of the concerns I've had is that, you know, when you had lifetime appointments and the average life expectancy in 1900 was 47, which meant living to 67 or 77 was somewhat extraordinary. Today, do we need a limitation on the age of Supreme Court judges? And or are we going to see it taken care of by the decision of the judges, justices themselves, to retire at a reasonable age?
Well, I think that's a couple of interesting questions there.
And if I've colored it somehow with my question, feel free to not to knock me back.
I would agree with you that there, it would be helpful, perhaps, not if there was an age limit per se, but perhaps some suggestion for the justices to consider at some point retirement and not holding on forever. And many state Supreme Courts or state courts in general have age limitations. For example, I practice in Florida, and there is an age cap of 70, basically. You can go a year or two beyond that, but by and large, at age 70, you have to retire from the bench, and then you can go to senior status. But a new judge will then fill your spot as an active judge. And perhaps 70 is awfully young, as you said. You know, our age has changed. You know, our lifespan has changed. But when you have justices who are 83 and, of course, 80, Justice Ginsburg is 83, Kennedy is 80, Breyer is right on his heels, you do wonder, would it make sense? But, of course, to do something about that, you'd be looking at perhaps a constitutional amendment, since the Constitution says quite clearly that judges serve with lifetime tenure, or some sort of agreement among this, you know, the Senate, the House, the President, and, of course, the justices themselves, some sort of gentleman's agreement or gentlewoman's agreement in 2017, that they will step down. It would be difficult, I think, to get that away from partisanship, but it certainly would seem to make sense. Although I will say the countervailing argument there, having been at the court recently and observed oral arguments, is that Justice Ginsburg is very much on the ball. When she's in oral argument, she has very cogent questions, and you may disagree with her on the substance of them, but she shows a very acute that she's done a very acute and close reading of the record and the briefs. And so perhaps it argues against it. But yes, I think that there's definitely among academics a move to try and get the justices to agree to an age limit.
So if Kennedy doesn't retire this year, do you think there's any doubt he will retire within the first term of Donald Trump? And if he's leaving, is Ginsburg likely to go behind him within the term of Donald Trump so that we'll see at least three Trump appointments in the first term?
I think that the betting money certainly is that Justice Kennedy would plan on retiring during a Republican administration. That being said, some wags will say he may want to wait for the 2018 election to see if perhaps there would be a moderating effect if the Senate were to shift just a little bit, and then he would perhaps be more comfortable with Democrats having control. Although I will say, just as from where I sit, I think you're looking at a stronger Senate majority for the Republicans based on the way President Trump has been governing and the way things seem to be going. So I don't know how that would play out. But I do think, yes, as for Kennedy, most people expect he would be retiring. He can retire when he wants, as we both know, but many people expect him to retire during the Trump administration. As for Justice Ginsburg, as I said, she's very much on the ball at oral argument, and she certainly heard, I would think, probably, I would say, disrespectfully, many people on the left telling her she needed to retire before President Obama's term was over. And so I would think if she wasn't willing to do that when the left was encouraging her to do so, not so quietly even, but rather in the media, I would think she might not want to do so now either. So I think she's there until circumstances require her to leave.
Boy, that means that if Trump gets a second term, she's going to be there for quite a while. She'll be there until she's 90, right?
Well, you know, like as I said, she's very much on the ball when she's at oral argument. I might disagree with her on the merits of her arguments, but she tends to know what she's talking about.
Yeah, I very much disagree with her on the merits of the arguments and her internationalist view of the Constitution and that we should pattern the U.S. Constitution after the South African Constitution and a few other things. I'm not a big admirer of Justice Ginsburg, but she does have a lifetime appointment. I guess she can stick around as long as she likes.
Yes, on the principles of the matter, you can be assured I would agree with you, Lars. But in terms of making the arguments from the other side, the big government arguments, if you will, Justice Kagan is certainly very good at that as well. But Ginsburg makes her arguments and makes them well. And that's probably why, say, Justice Scalia respected her so much. Even though he stridently disagreed with her, and he would explain why he disagreed with her, he did understand she was making substantive arguments for her position.
So in the last 10 seconds, how much do you think it pained Sotomayor and Ginsburg to have to vote in favor of upholding the Trump travel restriction?
Yeah, it's certainly to their credit, and I think it did pain them very much, though, yes.
And I'm sure they'll hear about it from all their friends.
And the thing is, they needed to vote that way. And it's nice, after the last 6 months of Sturm und Drang, when really the president should have such significant power when it comes to our safety of our country, it's nice to see them voting the right way on such an important issue.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Mark, thank you so much. Mark Miller from the Pacific Legal Foundation. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Bring honestly provocative talk everywhere you go. Search iTunes for the Lars Larson Show podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and you hear about the number of hours I work every day. I'm not complaining. I'm the one who signed up for it, 12, 13 hours a day. That means I have to get a great night's sleep. And I'll bet you've heard me talking about my Sleep Number bed and how well I sleep. My Sleep Number setting, in case you haven't heard it before, is 65. Tina, my wife's number, is usually a 35 or 40, but that's the beauty of the Sleep Number bed. You can adjust it. Well, the new Sleep Number 360 Smart Bed is designed to keep each one of you, effortlessly comfortable for your best possible night's sleep. And like all their beds, the Sleep Number 360 smart beds let you choose the ideal firmness and support on each side of the bed. That makes it the perfect bed for couples. So now the bed senses your every move and automatically adjusts to you, so you stay sleeping comfortably throughout the night. Did you know many of us fall asleep faster if your feet are just a little bit warm? Well, the Sleep Number 360 smart bed can even pre-warm each side of the bed individually, so it's just right for both of you. Does your bed do that? Did you know that Sleep Number beds cost about the same as a traditional mattress, and they last twice as long? It's time to meet the bed that could only come from Sleep Number, the 360 smart bed. And that's the only place you're going to find it. Now's a great time to come in during the lowest prices of the season, where you can save $500 to $700 on their most popular 2016 beds. Visit any of the 550 Sleep Number stores nationwide. I was just in one of the stores the other day picking out our new bed. Well, visit sleepnumber.com and find a Sleep Number store near you. And be sure to tell them that Lars sent you. Lots of things going on. I want to get to your calls now at 866-A-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. Let's go first to George in Nevada. KKFT is where you're listening. George, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yeah, on two things. On a travel ban, I was glad to see finally that we have a court that can see through the socialists. Right now you have Republicans and the socialists. Democrats have been disappeared. That this is not anything biased against any religious faction. It's against, and I can remember in the 1930s when my grandmother and them were alive, what this country's gone through. It is because those countries do not have proper ways of finding out if they're terrorists or not. We need something like that to protect this country, because it's not going away.
No, it's not going away. And you're right. And we need to vet people who are coming into this country. I had one of my regular emailers suggest to me about an hour ago. He said, Lars, you need to bring up the, he says M&Ms, I say jelly beans. But have you heard the jelly bean comparison before?
Sort of.
Here's the way it works. If I offer you, George, a bag that has 1,000 jelly beans, or if you like M&M's better, M&M's in it, and I tell you, I'd like to offer you these 1,000 jelly beans, and I will tell you that one of those 1,000 jelly beans is poisonous. It'll kill you. And I hand you this bag. You only have a 1 in 1,000 chance of picking the poisonous jelly bean. Are you going to eat any of the jelly beans in that bag?
I wouldn't, because I don't know which one is the good one.
That's right. Well, 999 of them are the good ones. But the point is to make the point, and I know there are plenty of people out there right now shouting at their radios saying, but people aren't jelly beans. No, they're not. But out of 1,000 refugees, if one of them is a terrorist who's going to kill you or hurt your family or attack your community, are you willing to let the 1,000 in if you know that one of them or two of them are poisonous? And the answer most people would give is no. We're not willing to let any of them in, because if we do that, we are putting our country at risk. And it's nothing more than most Americans would do with their own home. If a stranger came to your door at, say, midnight and banged on the door and said, help, I need some help, would you open the door and let him come into your house? And most of us would say, well, I'd call for help. I'd call the police. I'd call the paramedics. I'd call the fire department. But am I going to let this person into my house not knowing whether he's a danger to my family or not? Chances are he's not. But are you willing to take that chance? And suppose the chance is only 1 in 1,000 that this is a serial killer who's come to your door, or a rapist, or a robber, or a murderer. Even if it's only 1 in 1,000, most Americans would never take that kind of chance with their family's security. Well, if you wouldn't take it with your family's security, why in the world would you take that kind of chance with your country's security? Wouldn't you want to make sure that you knew who it was that you were letting in the door? And that's all Donald Trump has said, is he wants to make sure that the people who've come to the door are actually safe. By the way, Amazon.com, I thought this piece by Bloomberg was fascinating. They made the bid for almost $14 billion to buy Whole Foods. And John Mackey, who's head of Whole Foods, the company that Amazon just bought, said he was gushing about Amazon's technological innovation. He said, we'll be joining a company that's visionary. He said, I think we're going to get a lot of those innovations in our stores. I think we're going to see a lot of that technology. I think you're going to see Whole Foods Market evolve in leaps and bounds. And the question comes up, when all that technology comes in there, what are you going to do with all the unemployed people who no longer have jobs? I'm not saying that you should stick to old technology, not at all. Even if it's to preserve jobs, you remember when President Obama famously made the comment that ATMs had put a lot of people out of jobs because we didn't need as many bank tellers if you have an ATM doing much of their work. Well, the same thing applies to fast food and the same thing applies to grocery stores. But the question is, what are you going to do with all those people and how are the changes going to affect folks? Let's go to Joey in Michigan, listening on WILS. Hey, Joey, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hello, Lars. As long as we have Susan Collins and Ron Johnson as so-called Republicans,
yep,
steering the ship, are we going to have single payer before we have any capitalist system running 1/6 of the economy?
I hope not, Joey, because, you know, I just saw a news alert about literally 5 minutes ago that Susan Collins has now announced she will not vote for the Senate plan. And
so
here's the problem.
So basically,
go ahead.
So basically, we're going to push this into the heat of the election season where the Democrats are going to be able to frame it. And we're going to lose the whole populist message, and it's going to be framed as they're going to get the populist moral high ground.
What you say is absolutely true unless we get some people to grow a backbone and say, we have to make changes. We don't have the choice of sticking with the existing plan. It is it's sand under our feet that's being washed by the incoming tide. And it's not going to be there. So if everybody thinks, well, there's an option to just stick with what we've got. No, there's not an option to stick with what we've got. What we've got is a bad plan. It was a bad plan from the get-go. Many of us argued against it. But if you're not willing to accept some change without getting the whole pie, I think the conservatives like Lee and Rand Paul need to vote for this change, and I think Susan Collins should get on board as well. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.